Today, what we began last time as a little personal description of how a call to ministry became a life in a higher education becomes a little less personal.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
In discussing the background, the transition that happened in me of being called to ministry and then ending up in higher education, but in a ministry setting. I'm still in ministry. I'm still fulfilling my calling as I see it, understand it, and believe it. So I'm happy for all of that. It has come to my attention that there is a really interesting parallel between the value of what we obtain in a faith community, and especially in the expression of congregating on Sunday mornings in church or whenever it is that you congregate, there's an interesting parallel between that and the value of higher education as well. And so I want to delve right into, not rehash everything we did to lay the groundwork last time, but delve right into what that comparison is and what it is, therefore, that makes higher education so valuable. And as a side note, to come back in the conclusion, to what makes our faith community so important as well. And so we were talking last time at the very end about how an economic understanding of the value of higher education, that's not enough. It's important, but it's not enough. And the parts of the higher education world, the way we think about it, the trade schools and such, are hugely important, contribute tremendously to our society, and so do the very technical research-oriented parts of higher education that also undergird the whole economy and development of society and so on. I think there's incredible value in that. But there is also an inherent limitation to that. And I related it to Wilhelm von Humboldt before and the libertarian perspective that he had. Of course, this is before we would think of modern libertarians the way we think of them. But at the end of the 18th century, the 1700s, when he's writing The Limits of State Action and trying to describe how important it is that we allow people to find the best avenues for themselves if we want to get the most benefit from the wide variety of people and personalities and gifts and talents that individuals have and that we have within a society. So the point, following that perspective, and this leads into today's discussion, in a free society, and this is the reason we want it to be free, it's not just personal pleasure, it's that we realize that the channels we've already carved out for people's lives may not be in the best places. It's sort of like having laid all the sidewalks and then finding ruts across the grass where people have actually walked and realizing maybe we should have put the sidewalk somewhere else. That happens in our societies overall. We lay out the structure that we think is going to work and is going to be the best. And over time, we realize this is not the most productive path, or we discover new things that give us a way to be transported by airplanes and not need a highway in that particular place and so on. So the point in a free society is that you have to leave room. And this is uncomfortable for most of us who've been in the conservative world most of our lives. You have to leave room for radical paths, and radical just means outside the norm. They don't do what everybody else expects them to do. And but just because that word is so controversial, I need to make a point on the side here about vocabulary and how we sometimes hamper our own attempts at doing the best we can do by alienating words themselves, or eliminating our own options by not allowing ourselves to consider a word like liberal or radical or conservative or Catholic, for instance. And all of those words are easily put into these categories that make them so anathema for one side or the other that you can't even say them without being ignored for the rest of what you're going to utter. And that's a shame. That's a huge loss. Disdaining ideas, and this is not just vocabulary, disdaining ideas to the point of forbidding the utterance of their lexical stand-ins, you know? So you can't say liberal. When I'm talking about liberal arts education sometimes, people will say, you can't say liberal. That's not what's going on. That, it has nothing to do with being progressive or not progressive. And the term liberal arts in higher education is a completely different thing. The forbiddance of uttering the lexical stand-ins for certain ideas because those ideas are so toxic in certain circles, it just, all that does by limiting our vocabulary is construct more and more interior walls in our already shrinking world until we've hemmed in ourselves with nowhere to go and no safe way out. No, I can only speak about these things and these ideas, and anything else can't even be considered. Now, I know nobody chooses to do that on purpose, but I know also that we live in circles that function that way. Oh, I'm just, you turn them off as soon as that word comes out. We have to do better than that. We did it with CRT and things like that over the last few years. Even just to mention inclusion or diversity, it's like, oh, I know that's the key word that, what, prevents us from being able to talk, from being able to think about what the ideas actually are, even if you disagree with the ideas at the end. Dismissing it immediately is just, okay, so you got the point. So here's what I think goes into making higher education so valuable. Even when it feels a little outside the walls we've constructed to keep ourselves safe. And one of the ingredients to that is so simple and obvious, and it also, just in expressing it, it's going to make some of us a little uncomfortable. There is a respect for learning, for expertise. That's what higher education is about. You know, when I was around a few educators, and I mean people who are committed to higher education, they're in the program, they are professors and so on. When I was around a group like this not too long ago, and they were just dismissing out of hand some of the things that were being said by experts, and I'm making that sound the same way they were making the sound. Experts are saying this and that about health or about whatever it was that was in that situation. When I was around them and they were mocking expertise as if you shouldn't trust it, I was like, you only have a job because you're an expert in your discipline. And if you think about your discipline, you realize how complex it was for you to learn all the different little nuances that allowed you to then get this degree that you ended up with. And you know how foolish it is when people walk up to you from the street and who don't know anything about your discipline and tell you, oh, well, if you just understood this, you'd know blah, blah, blah. And you're like, man, that is so many steps from being fully informed. That's because you have expertise. Higher education has built into it a respect for expertise. And I respect expertise. When people study, this is weird. This is very strange. When people study, they tend to learn things. And they learn things that people that didn't study that don't know. And as it turns out, knowing things is better than not knowing things. That's how I think of the value of higher education in this level, which is, I mean, it sounds just mocking, but honestly, in this world today and in the circles I run in, I have to say it. That's part of the value of higher education. We have a respect for learning and for expertise. I have said in my circles, I'm Baptist. I have said in my circles, Baptists love to love education, but they don't love education. We have a tendency as Baptists, and again, I'm picking on my crowd. I don't know about yours, but in my crowd, we have a tendency to value getting the credential and value having gone through the gauntlet, but then to dismiss as if it's toxic in some way that ivory tower education that some people get. And that doesn't work. It's either valuable or not valuable. And we shouldn't be pretending that we're going to use the system that we don't actually trust. But I've got the credentials, so you should believe me if you're not actually going to respect the institution. And I'm not saying that in a staid way, like you just have to trust us because we've been educated. The whole point of higher education in a free society is that everybody's ideas get heard. All the ideas get measured against each other. And because they're all respected, guess which ideas float to the top? The best ideas float to the top. That doesn't mean it's not sometimes dominated by a personality or corruption or a toxic environment or stuff like that. But overall, that's the value of the academy. You have this whole country full of people who are testing each other's ideas to see if they actually hold water. And you know what? Most of those people are intellectually honest. When they get tested by an idea that's better than theirs, they say, I hadn't thought of that. I'm going to need to rethink this. I'm going to need to go through this again. And we actually learn things from each other. There is a respect for learning and for expertise. And to start doubting all experts, to start dismissing them and being supercilious about them, yes, raising an eyebrow, you know, is to start rejecting the foundations of what it, you're going to think this sentence is exaggerated, but it's not. It is to start rejecting the foundations of what it means to belong to humanity. So think about it. Human interactions culminate. And if you don't agree with this, you should go back and listen to some of the Hannah Arendt shows we did recently, just talking about how the human condition, you know, I did several shows in a row, episodes in a row, where we talked about the human condition. This is just part of the nature of humanity. To be human, to interact as a human, is to interact in language. It culminates in language. When I've talked about logic and meaning in my logic classes, when I teach logic, one of the things about logic that makes it doable, that makes it something we can study meaningfully, is the reality that the meaning of a sentence is its truth value. So now I want to give a whole lecture on why this is the case, but that sounds strange. Like the meaning of a sentence, it is raining, is caught up entirely in whether that statement is true or false. And you would say, no, there's a lot more meaning to that sentence than just that it's true or false. That's not the point. The point is that you can measure the entire value of that sentence in whether it's true or false. And I know I'm not going to give the whole lecture, so you just stay with me one more minute and we'll be out of this philosophical pothole I've got us in right now, okay? But this is the point, that every single sentence in reality includes a part we don't say. And it's the opening to the sentence. We just assume it's there. So I say it's raining. What I actually mean is it is true that it is raining. You assume that I'm actually saying it is true that it is raining, because I don't say it's raining and then you say, wait a minute, what do you mean by that? Do you mean it's not raining or do you mean it is raining? You know what I mean by the sentence, by the truth value of that sentence. The nature of human language is that we assume we're telling each other the truth. That's what we assume. Now, over time, we learn not to trust certain people. We become dubious. We become skeptical. We become judges of character and what's true and not true and so on. But it is undermining in every step the very basis of the relationships we are able to have, which are premised on the truth value of the things that are being said. So one way to describe the enterprise of higher education, everything we're trying to accomplish in higher education, is that we're inviting students into the language of the experts. And sometimes the language sounds esoteric. I mean, who cares about certain vocabulary if you're not going to be in that discipline, right? It sounds esoteric within a discipline, but that's what we're doing. We're saying to students, hey, you don't know the magic lingo that we use in this discipline, so let me teach you the vocabulary so that you can start saying the things that we know how to measure as true or false and so on. But the other half of that, we're teaching the lingo, we're teaching the vocabulary, but we're also acknowledging the sincerity of the people who are committed to that language. There are all kinds of people in higher education I disagree with. They think the solutions are sometimes therapeutic when I think the solution is redemptive. There are others who think the solution is going to be redemptive when I think the solution is therapeutic. And I could do that with almost anything, politics, economics, philosophy, any discipline you want to pick out. I have people I agree with and people I disagree with in those disciplines. I disagree with people who are advocating for what I would call toxic masculinity, people who are advocating for using politics in a purely power motivated way, those who grasp the absurdity, let me restate that. Those whose grasp of the absurdity inherent in a lot of the conceptions we have of the world can turn them into cynics of anything meaningful at all. They mock every effort at objective description. I disagree with those people. When they say, oh, you know, that's not true, therefore I don't believe anybody has the truth, I disagree with them completely. But one of the great advantages to working and living and learning on a college campus, for instance, where I get to work, is the constant exposure to people who live every day in the vocabulary of what is in most of the world extraordinary, and learning that I can respect them and learn from them, even if I disagree with some of the things that they're saying. There is a value to expertise in and of itself that then I can carry into the evaluation I give to whether I agree with someone or not. There is also in that environment a respect for other viewpoints, even within a specific discipline. So, importantly, in higher education, the point is not that a professor inculcate an ideology into a student. We're not just training students to think the way we do. That's one of the reasons institutions need to include a variety of perspectives. You need professors who disagree with each other. I've heard professors in classrooms sort of make, in a joking way, but also sort of an honest way, have arguments with other professors without that professor being in the room. Well, I know such and such who believes this and that. And they use their students as sort of the go-between in the debate between the two professors. I think there's actually great value in that because the students are getting to hear competing sides of a set of ideas and develop the ability then to evaluate those and come to their own conclusions about it. So, you know, look, all of that's higher education. I get it. Some of you are like, I don't really have to talk about higher education. Okay. Well, that's exactly the same idea. It's very similar to what makes Sunday morning at church, as I'm talking about it, you know, congregating with believers. I don't just mean Sunday morning. That's just the traditional time, right? But it's what makes that so valuable as well. It's a respect for other people, the other, the people whose opinions are different from your own, a respect for the other value that people bring. Those in the categories are not mutually exclusive. They're not necessarily opposed to each other. And they work back and forth when we're around people who are different than us. So what I'm about to talk about, I'm about to describe one reason there's so much value in being around the other, you know, people who are not like us on Sunday morning in a worship service or in a congregation or in a Bible study or whatever it is you're doing. What I'm about to describe is not, it's not like it's one or the other of these. They're not competitive with each other because it's going to sound that way, and I don't want it to sound that way even from the beginning. But one reason it's so important to be around the other in the context of faith, for instance, is the empathetic, the need for empathy, and the fact that, like, you have these people who are empathetic. And when a person is pragmatic, and I'm making it sound like those are competitive with each other, they don't have to be competitive. A pragmatic person could be empathetic. I get it. But just stick with me through the illustration for a second. If you're in a congregation, you can see people who are purely pragmatic in their outlook about life. I mean, it's just, how do we get this done? How does the accounting work? How do we set, you know, what's the most efficient way to get through this service and so on? And then you have these other people who are empathetic, like, to the extreme. And you can tell which side of this I'm on because I'm already prejudicing against the empathetic. I mean, they're like, oh, I care about so much. We need to, it's all relational, and I got to be around how I feel what you're feeling and so on. It's incredibly valuable to be around people who are not like us, exactly the same way, for instance, that someone earning a degree in social work or in sociology can benefit from someone who understands economics. Again, they're not entirely mutually exclusive. But there is a different sense of value in most of the people who focus one direction or the other. I mean, a person who's inclined to go into social work, and this is so different for different people, I know. I'm just painting with a very broad brush here. You know, they're going into social work, maybe even sociology, although that would be a much more mathematical sort of approach to this. But let's just talk about social work for a second. They're doing it on the basis of a desire to help this certain class of people. I want to go and help children who are displaced from their homes, or I want to help families who are struggling to make ends meet, or I want to, you know, I want to be in the system, help people who are getting out of the criminal justice system and trying to make their way back into life, whatever. I want to get a degree in social work so that I can get involved in people's lives. You know, that's completely different than a person who says, I really want to sit in here and study the math behind our economy and figure out how to make it efficient, and comes to conclusions that might seem destructive to individual families. But in the end, maybe they're not. I'm just saying, the point is, they're thinking about the world in completely different ways. It could be really helpful, and it is, when you cross-pollinate, as people say, between those disciplines, and you get to know someone as an economist who is a social worker, or vice versa. The point is, it benefits us when we're being affected by people who are different from us, who think differently than we think. It's the same as saying, you know, an analytic person can benefit in a congregation from the perspective of someone who's relational, just like a mathematician can benefit by knowing a poet, or a person who's decisive, no problem making decisions whatsoever, from the perspective of someone who's extremely cautious, circumspect about every decision they're going to make. In the same way, an entrepreneur can benefit from a CPA. We need all of those different perspectives for us to have a better understanding of the world around us, and to fit into that world better, and to contribute more to the world. Heaven forbid my thoughts should be the only thoughts that shape anything. What we need is to contribute our thoughts to the whole pool of everybody else's thoughts, and then that benefits everyone. That's what coming together in a congregation, for instance, on a Sunday does, and what coming together with others inside of a discipline in higher education, or between the disciplines in higher education, can bring. And so what I'm trying to get at is just, if we can consider where we are in our own life's current state, then it should include figuring out how our community, and especially I think our faith community, and our learning community, is affecting that. Otherwise, we're very likely to end up with our feet mired in a pit where we're not going to make any, we're not going to grow, we're not going to change, we're not going to mature, we're not going to progress, we're not going to become better at anything. We're just going to be what we are. For a lot of people, that's all they want. And I'm not even saying that in a hyper-judgmental way. I mean, I hear it all the time. Nope, my mind's made up. I know what I'm doing. Here I stand. I can do no other. They think they're Martin Luther, you know, at the table. Or they examine themselves and just believe they're good enough. I don't think that's what we're supposed to think about ourselves. And, you know, through now into my sixth decade of life, I think I can justify saying I don't think we should ever arrive at a conclusion that we're good enough. We can always learn more, grow more, be more, have better faith, have better understanding. And so as you consider, as we consider our own life's current state, I would say, realize just a couple of things. Number one, realize the value of a faith community. And not the value of a faith community because they're smarter than you or because they agree with you. Not that. Not like, oh, I just need to learn and believe everything they're going to say. Not in the sense of joining a cult and just buying everything that's coming from the front of the building. It's not that. It's not just that somebody is smarter, as we mentioned the other day, last time. It's not also, though, that they're just saying the things you want to agree with. Oh, yeah, I like what they say. They're affirming everything I thought. I must have been a genius. It's not because they're smarter, it's not because they agree with you, but because you need input, which can cause you to consider some of, you know, what may be on the other side, more rigidly held, but on your own side, the same way, more rigidly held, and sometimes in our own lives, I mean, come on, let's admit it, often unexamined parts of our outlook on living. We just assume these things are okay, and it's been comfortable enough, so maybe that's all we need to do. We need input to that. We need somebody who's willing to jab a pin, some kind of stick into that little membrane we've built up that says, I'm perfectly fine, and bleed it out, you know, make us see that we're not perfectly fine, that there's more that we could understand or know. I mean, think about it. When you're in a congregation and you hear a description of some people group that's in need, you know, hey, we found out about this community across the sea, you know, in some state or nation somewhere else that we can go and help and serve. What are you doing? You're hearing from someone about a need you are not going to be aware of. As simple as that one is, hey, we're going to go serve this people group. We're going to dig a well over in this part of the world, or we're going to take some food or some medicine, or we're just going to take the gospel. And I mean that just in the terms of pure and simple. We're just going to go tell the good news. We're going to go somewhere where you wouldn't have even thought of. We're going to go there because we've brought your attention to it and given you an ability to do something you wouldn't have thought of doing otherwise. As simple as that is, that's what I mean by all of this. In the same way that a teacher in a Sunday school class or journey group or whatever your church calls them, or a pastor at the front of the room, or a person giving a lecture on a Wednesday night could pull up a passage or a history, a biography, or a creed and just say, look, here's a phrase you probably haven't thought about. And let me provoke you to think about what this might mean for you. It does the same thing. It reshapes us in ways to prevent the lethargy that goes with so much of our lives if we're not around other people nudging us and poking and prodding us to do something a little better. So a side benefit to this that's really important is that it can help us climb out of a lot of the conspiracy theories and the being stuck in thinking of the entire world as being in a conspiracy against our particular political movement. And there are errors on both sides of the political spectrum right now. There are. But on the conspiracy side, you know, that's on the conservative side right now. The right is pulling at conspiracies as a way of saying you can't trust any of the stuff that's going on. Not everybody, but some are in that world. And on the left, there is a constant appeal to power and fascism as the thing that we're overcoming and so on. And so there is a way that we also need to say to the left, hey, you're unfairly characterizing the majority of people who are on the opposite side of you politically. But I'm talking now to the people I'm around who are on the right and who might be stuck in a conspiracy. Well, how can we trust the elections? Or how can I believe the medical industry? Or how can I believe this or that? And I understand when you get into that world, sometimes it gets really hard to get out of it. And one of the benefits of being around people who have a variety of perspectives and understanding is that it gives you a ladder for climbing out of the algorithmic echo chamber of opinion shows, because opinion shows are designed to keep an audience. So they are designed to say the things you want to hear. I want to pick on a guy by name, but I'm not going to. Back in the early 2000s and into the 2010s, I listened to a lot of conservative media, and there was one particular figure who was just the dominant figure all the time. And I listened after a few years, I listened to this person speaking and thought to myself, I mean, it was just so obvious in this one particular show that they were doing. They're just pandering to their audience. They're not giving any evidence. They're not giving any objective information. They're not providing any, even intellectual stimulation. They're just saying what they want their audience to hear. And then I realized that's what's happened. That's why CNN goes to the left and Fox News goes to the right. And then Fox News isn't far enough right because they're willing to allow a left voice to be heard every once in a while. So we need another social media platform or media platform. So they won't even allow those leftists at Fox News to get in. That kind of listening only to the viewpoints we agree with. No wonder we're stuck in all these conspiratorial pits. If you want a ladder for climbing out of that algorithmic echo chamber of opinion shows and social media and conspiracies, then this is it. It gives us something better, some voice that says, oh, now, wait a minute. You know, I'm honest, and I don't think that. I mean, you sit with me at a meal, and you know I'm not out to take all your stuff. So let's talk about it in a different way. Hearing both, even fanatical sides of whatever's going on will extrude. And this is just the truth. You can listen to two extreme shows, one on the right, one on the far left. And if you hear both fanatical sides, it will extrude in the middle, which is your mind, just enough goo for you to notice the solid bases on top of which all the nonsense is being layered. There is enough information out there for us to make more reasonable decisions, but not if all your information comes from one side. And I'm not advocating for you to flip channels all the time. I'm advocating for you to go to stinking church. And it stinks because it's full of people, and it's full of people who think wrong thoughts. You're one of them. But all those wrong thoughts together produce this image of Christ and give us an ability to know something we wouldn't know otherwise. So as you're considering your own life's current state, one thing is to think about the value of a faith community where you get to be around people who are not like you. Secondly, consider the value of a learning community. So again, it's a personal show because I'm in ministry and I'm in higher education, and my higher education institution is one that's missional and committed to Christian ministry. So it all fits together for me. Isn't that great? Anyway, realize the value of a learning community for your life, not just because you gain a credential. Look, I got the credential. A lot of people who come to our school, to any school, I know this. I've been in all the formats, a private sort of non-Christian setting, public university settings, and in a private, very Christian, very doctrinally oriented school. And, you know, everybody goes to school, not everybody, so many people go to school to begin with because they just want to get the credential. I already know everything. I already know everything I'm going to do. I just need somebody to put their stamp of approval on it and say that I'm a genius already. And it's one of the things I do here at this school is help people who think they know everything about the Bible, who think they know everything about God, who think they know everything about all these disciplines and just want the credential, to say to them, you don't know nearly as much as you think you do. And it's going to get shaken up while you're here. And you need that. You need someone to help you with it. So it's not just gaining a credential when you go to school. That's the value of higher education. It goes way beyond that. It's because we all need to rely on people who know things we don't. We have to rely on that. No one can Google themselves into building the whole society. You can't do it. And yet we're pretending to do that with everything we need everyone else's expert opinion for, so that we don't have to rely on the experts anymore. Well, I Googled it. I did serious internet research, you know, and I figured it out. Now, I'm from Texas, so I can make fun of my own accent and just let it out every once in a while. So we need to rely on people who know things we don't, and because we each need to become a little better than we already are. It's just part of the reality of who we are. We need to be better. We need someone else to tug on our bootstraps. So, you know, what I suggest is that we take off the foil hats, you know, we're sometimes used to having on, to keep from having to think about things we don't agree with. That's what I mean by the foil hats in this case. Not that you're actually thinking of little green men, you know, coming in. So my suggestion is we take off the foil hats we're using to keep from having to think about things we don't agree with, and actually seek out the voices that make us learn about things we don't already know, and consider things that we haven't already adopted. In other words, Let's show that we actually believe in the truth. Not that we have to control the truth, but that the truth can set us free. Veritas liberabit vos.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.